Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So this is the final episode in a long series of over 30 hours and nearly 40 episodes from Venice Immersive 2025. And I wanted to end on this lecture that I gave on June 6, 2026 at Seattle XR. So I was invited to come up and talk about my experiential design framework and immersive storytelling. And so this is an opportunity to really dig into the elemental theory of presence. So like the different active presence, mental social presence, the embodied environmental presence, as well as emotional presence, and then kind of give a philosophical rooting on process philosophy and looking at Empedocles and ancient philosophies, but also looking at this broader process relational foundations and metaphysical foundations upon all of this, and how I'm drawing upon existing literature from experiential advertising as applied to presence theory, as pioneered by Douglas Chertoff, but also this independent recreation of some of these different frameworks, and just as a way of looking at these different equivalence classes of understanding the nature of experiential design. So in the process after I gave this talk, there's this three-part process that I'm going through. One is just kind of like defining all of these different systems and frameworks and then coming up with some general definitions, which I did a lot more of within the context of applying it to all of these different experiences. There's a bit of like having this framework, but then actually applying it to how to describe the archetypal character of the story. And then also eventually at some point, it may potentially be useful as an experiential design framework. There's still a bit of an open question, honestly, as to whether or not what I'm doing is more of a critical framework to help me to understand my own phenomenological experiences and to schematize them and understand them and to describe them, and to what extent it's going to be able to be generalized in a way that could be useful for people outside of me to be able to actually design and create different experiences based upon some of these different principles. So that's the kind of idea. What are the different trade-offs that you're doing, and how can you start to map out that space at these fusion of what ends up being this interdisciplinary combination of all these different design disciplines coming together? There seems to be some elemental similarities that I can see exhibited within the context of these different experiences that I see on the festival circuit. And so I'll be explaining that. And then I think also in the course of how I've been applying it through these last like nearly 40 episodes now is going through and been talking around the overall story synopsis, or like what's the story about, the different contextual domains that are being explored in terms of like here are the different places that you're going through to be able to tell the story, and then the elemental balance, which is what is the center of gravity, what's the kind of root of the experience, is this more like a game, is it more like a film, is it more like an architectural space, is it more of like a space where you're using your mind and solving puzzles and or kind of having these social dynamics, and then to what degree is the second, third, and fourth level of the center of gravity in terms of the combination of those? And so I've been sort of ordering those different elements just to get a sense of my own take in terms of my own experience of how I'm receiving some of these different projects, and also the different emphasis to kind of describe the structure and form of the piece, and hopefully through the context of the oral history conversations, get a sense of how that may actually feel or play out, or different questions as I talk to these different creators, because this is essentially the way that I'm making sense of like the challenge of watching like over 30 hours of content over the course of like a week, and then having over 30 hours of conversation. How do you manage that? How do you remember what even happened? And then how do you even have an intelligible conversation with somebody? And I feel like as I've been doing this over the years, this has been a bit of my process to kind of like have this bit of a memory palace that is schematizing and understanding and remembering how a piece is telling a story through all these different modalities, and then having a conversation with them to be able to help document it so that I can remember what happened, you know, because most people won't have a chance to see these pieces, just to have a sort of a record. So that's kind of the intent of this lecture that I gave, and I already posted it onto YouTube back on January 29th. And so hopefully you can also take a look at the actual visuals of this talk, since it's very dense. It's a lot of visual communication that's happening above and beyond what I'm saying. And I'm using the references of the slides to say the final transmission, but the slides, I think, are kind of doing a lot of heavy lifting of also explaining these concepts that are maybe a little bit more not enough context to get fully without the full context of seeing the visuals. And I've also been in the process of integrating different aspects of Peircean semiotics of his firstness, secondness, and thirdness. Maybe I'll add a little bit to the write-up, or maybe I'll just save that for another talk at some point, but I'll at least add maybe the descriptions and definitions of how I've been thinking about the different aspects of essentially the firstness is the potentiality of all the possibilities of what's possible. And the secondness is kind of like the differentiation that makes it grounded. And the third is kind of the mediating interpretant that's going between those. So you can think about in the meaning that you're trying to communicate is like their first archetypal non-Boolean space. And then as you have a meaning you want to communicate, then you choose a word and a symbol to refer to that. And then as a person who's receiving that, you're seeing that word and you're trying to infer what the meaning and what it's pointing back to look at this larger space of possibilities. So it's going from the firstness is that non-Boolean space of possibilities. The secondness is the Boolean space of the actualities. And the thirdness is this mediation between those two from a Proustian semiotics perspective. And it's a very powerful framework that I think has really taken off in lots of different ways of analyzing different aspects of communication and biosemiotics and theories of actualization within the context of biology. It's like a super robust, simple, elegant framework that Charles Sanders Peirce has come up with that I've also been applying to Alfred North Whitehead's theories of actualization, as well as his own theories of concrescence, mapping up the elements that I've already been using just to kind of make it a little bit more intuitive into a metaphysics of both the process relational metaphysics of Alfred North Whitehead, as well as Charles Sanders Peirce, that I'm sort of trying to find a bridge between these two different frameworks that are very similar in a lot of ways, but they also have a lot of distinct differences. And so I think through the elements, there may be this kind of mediating force to be able to do that, but also through the process of experiential design and looking at it through the context of these experiences and these elements in this experiential design framework seems to be some really exciting potential bridges between the frameworks of both Charles Sanders Peirce and Alfred North Whitehead. So anyway, there's a lot of deep philosophical work that I think is also a big part of trying to come up with some strong foundations for these different approaches that can be robust enough to be generalized and applied to lots of different contexts. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this is a lecture that I called The Blending of the Elements that I did at Seattle XR within Seattle, Washington on June 6th, 2026. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and today I'm going to be talking about blending the elements of experiential design. And so I've been doing the Voices of VR podcast since 2014, and so I've published over 1,700 interviews. For the last 10 years, I've been going to all sorts of immersive storytelling places like Sundance Immersive, Venice Immersive, Tribeca Immersive, South by Southwest Immersive, IFA Doc Lab. And so I'm seeing a lot of these immersive stories and seeing how people are using immersive technologies, experiential design, immersive storytelling all together. And so today I'm going to be breaking down my experiential design framework that I've been using to understand these stories, but also digging into a bit of the elemental theory of presence. I'll be talking about some of the philosophical roots of the elements and digging into a bit of like process philosophical foundations that I've been leaning upon. And then I'll be going through blending of the elements. And so looking at this kind of interdisciplinary fusion of how these different projects are blending all these different things together. Okay, so there's this quote from Margaret McKee that I think does a really great job of describing the nature of storytelling. He says that true character is revealed in the choices a human being makes under pressure. The greater the pressure, the deeper the revelation, the truer the choice to the character's essential nature. And so you can think about that as, you know, you're watching a story and seeing those people make those choices and take action. But in an immersive experience, you're the one who's being put into that context. You're being put under pressure. You're making choices and taking action. And then your essential character is being revealed. That's sort of like the idea. And there's a story that's unfolding over time. And so if we're going to break that down, it's context, quality, character, and story. So quality are the different qualities of presence. We have active presence, mental and social presence, embodied and environmental presence, and emotional presence. These are all the different qualities of presence. They're like equivalence classes that are all happening all at the same time, but there's going to be different ways that experiences are kind of having a center of gravity, or they're context switching, or they're kind of emphasizing one or the other. But when you see an experience, you'll see like some gist of like the center of gravity. As an example, video games are a lot about agency and expressing activity and exploration and will, creativity. And so you have a real opportunity to express your will and engagement, and that's active presence. And the mental and social presence, these are all the ways that we use language to be able to communicate and have like semiotic transmissions of meaning. But you have everything from literature and books, but the internet, the World Wide Web, social media, these are all the ways that we're creating these connections with other people. So there's a degree of mental and social presence that comes with that air element. And then the water element is the ways that we are watching a film. It's a modulation of our emotions with the consonants and dissonant cycles, but we also have music that is modulating our emotions as well as lighting. So this is kind of like media that's unfolding over time in a time-based medium like cinema. And then finally, XR is bringing in things like architecture, theater, and dance. These are all the different spatial dimensions that we haven't had an opportunity to have like in a mass communication media. But now with XR, you're able to create these virtual representations of that, but also create a sense of embodiment. So this is the embodied and environmental presence, the way that you're actually putting your body into the experience and have a direct sensory experience. You have taking action, making choices, sensory experience, and emotional aversion. So again, you have active presence, mental, social presence, emotional presence, and embodied environmental presence. And I'll be digging into much more in these elements in the last part of this talk, but this is kind of a little bit of a sneak preview as I start to continue to unpack those four elements. Now, the next equivalence class of this experiential design framework is context. And so there's all these different domains of human experience. And so you have yourself, your other, home, family. But whenever I ask people, what is the ultimate potential of virtual reality? They'll answer into one of these contextual domains. They'll say, oh, it's around training, or you'll be able to use it for productivity or medicine or education or expression of your identity, accessibility needs, hanging out with friends. So each of these have different contextual domains. You know, when I ask people the ultimate potential, they lean into one of those. But also context has a lot to do with identity. I am Kent Bai, that's who I am. I'm Patreon supported, I'm a writer, I'm a son, I'm a part of a family, I'm a knowledge artist. I aspire to walk every day, even if I don't do it every day. I have an aspirations to have an identity of being a daily walker. And so there's a brand new book that just came out by Joseph Pine called The Transformation Economy. It says that all transformation has to do with identity change. So you can think about, I am this, but I want to be this. I'm an aspiring philosopher. I just recently gave my first professional philosophy talk. So there's ways in which that you can think about your identity now, but what you want to live into, but these have to do with different contextual domains. And so there's a tight connection between context and identity, as well as with privacy. So that's what Helen Niesenbaum figured out with her theory of contextual integrity, theory of privacy, where she says that privacy is around the appropriate flows of information given the context. So as an example, if you're at your bank, you give bank information and you talk about your finances, but you're not necessarily going to be talking about the nuances of your finances to your doctor. That's way more granular information that's not contextually appropriate. Just the same, you're not going to be at your bank talking about your medical conditions, because that's like information that's only really appropriate to be shared with your doctor. So the theory of contextual integrity is showing that there's these different contexts have the appropriate flows of information. But for Helen Niesenbaum, this is very difficult for her to like come up with a grand theory of context. And there isn't actually an established universally accepted philosophy of privacy, which means that you have these big tech companies that are be able to exploit that and to use things like contextually aware AI to violate all of our different aspects of privacy. So context is very important for AI. You have context engineering from Anthropic. You have Meta talking around contextually aware AI, where you basically have these omniscient AI bots that are going to be watching everything you do now across every context. And that sort of violates the principles of contextual integrity, which is an argument that I'll point to here later. But you think about like immersive art from like Meowwolf. All of a sudden you're being at home, you walk through a door, and then all of a sudden you're in sort of this surreal liminality. And so a lot of immersive art is like taking you from one immersive context to another immersive context. But in the context of immersive storytelling, you have the ability to place people directly into the spatial relations of that context. And once you're in that context, you're able to modulate someone's consciousness. So there is this relationship between context, privacy, and identity. And so I wrote a paper. It was at a symposium for the Stanford Cyber Policy Center. They had a whole existing law and extended reality. And so I wrote a paper about the privacy pitfalls of contextually aware AI, basically arguing that contextually aware AI is going to basically destroy all of our privacy, because if we have these things paying attention to everything that we do all at once, then we're not going to have any privacy anymore because of the third-party doctrine. And, you know, I basically go into that whole argument. But this is sort of a mapping of personally identifiable information into this model, just to have at least some sort of framework to say, hey, even though there isn't an established philosophy of privacy, let's push back against this idea of contextual aware AI, because we're going down a really dark path if we do. I've also done a lot of work in terms of ethics, and so looking at these different contextual domains and started to look at the different ethical and moral dilemmas. So this is a talk that I gave of XR Ethics Manifesto, and I've done a talk at Laval Ritual that will have much more details digging into that. Also, there's Alex McDowell, who has a whole world-building mandala that, when you think about the context of world-building, that's the same thing where you have different aspects of like the governance, the self, the culture. And so, you know, it's this idea that in order to actually build immersive experiences, you have to have some sort of like model of world building, but it's essentially like developing these contextual domains. Okay, so that's context. Character. So character is like, there's this connection between value theory, which is like each moment sort of containing this value and meaning and purpose. And so for Alfred North Whitehead's priceless philosophy, he's saying that every single moment is filled with value. In philosophy, it's called axiology. It's value theory. What is valuable and what's meaningful? And so there's this idea that as you go through these experiences, you're kind of expressing different aspects of archetypal character or value theory. So you have this kind of model of like this virtue continuum. We have like integrity, discernment, love, respect, humility, diligence, temperance, and courage. And we have deficits and excess. But you can think about like each immersive experiences may be focusing on one of these different things, like the Cliders looking at the balance between power and control. And so they're looking at these different archetypal characters and then creating experiences to be able to express that. And there's also different feelings and needs when you start to think about like writing a story. You think about what is the needs, what are the feelings, and that can also be a part of the character that you're exploring. So that's the character of the story. There's lots of different story structures with immersive media, and I'll be digging into this spectrum a little bit further. But the idea is that there's a balance between author narrative and generative narrative, and on that spectrum, there's different types of story structures that we'll talk a bit about here at the last part of this talk. Okay, so that's a quality, character, context, and story. These are the kind of equivalence classes that I think about breaking down experiential design. In this talk, I'm going to be digging way deep into the quality aspects. Okay, so we're talking about the elemental theory of presence. So presence is something that anybody who's in XR, you see lots of different people. Like when I went to the Oculus Connect 1, Brendan Irbe is the CEO of Oculus. He's on stage talking about presence as being this key thing about XR technologies. And when I was at Oculus Connect 1, I had a chance to talk to Sebastian Kuntz, who's been a longtime part of the XR community. And so he's written about Mel Slater's ideas of presence. So I did an interview with him. When I went to France, IEEE, I did an interview with Mel Slater for the first time, and then also talked to Richard Scarbez, who's also a presence researcher, who's kind of building upon Slater's ideas. So Slater's basic ideas is that there's a place illusion, a plausibility illusion. He was talking about this in 2009. And so place illusion is that the strong illusion of being in a place in spite of sure knowledge that you know that you're not there. Plausibility illusion is that the illusion that what is apparently happening is really happening, even though you know for sure that it is not. So one of the things about Slater is that he has this illusionary framing where because it's VR, you have the sensory motor contingencies that he's really interesting in looking at the neuroscience of it. What are the things that make virtual reality a unique medium that you can't do with anything else? And so one of those is the plausibility illusion, kind of tricking like your expectations that you're feeling that whatever your experience is completely plausible, even though it's kind of a virtual representation. And the place illusion is that you're being placed into a spatial context and that you trick your mind into actually being there. So I had been thinking about like other ways of thinking about presence, because like for me, there were things like emotional presence and social presence that were not necessarily being represented by that. So I reached out to Richard Scarbez and he pointed me to Dustin Chertoff's work that he was doing. You know, once I saw Chertoff, that there was such a mapping between what I was doing and what he was doing, I started talking more publicly around this kind of elemental theory of presence in like February, March of 2017. And then so Chertoff, this is like predates me, and he was writing this before I even got into VR, and I didn't discover it until Scarbez told me about it. But he's essentially had the same idea that I'd had, which is that he saw that the existing presence theories were woefully inadequate. He was turning to experiential advertising, and then in experiential advertising, he was finding much more robust theories. And so part of his dissertation was to go through and review all the different components of presence and then start to categorize them. And for him, he came up with sensory, cognitive, affective, and relational. And so if I map it onto this, it's basically equivalent. Active presence, cognitive and relational, affective I have as emotional presence, and sensory I have embodied and environmental presence. And so I had a chance to talk and do an interview with Chertoff in 2017. And so one of the things that happens in presence theory is that basically people are talking about the same thing, but they're kind of using slightly different words. And so you can look to things like Jung and archetypes where there's like a archetypal representation of that. And I think the elements kind of represent that. And so for Jung, he was saying that there's kind of a non-Boolean nature to archetypes where they can't be reduced down to a simple formula, but there is these kind of archetypal complexes that have the same type of thing, but they're just talking about the different nuances of it. And that's what a lot of what I see when I look at the presence research is that people are kind of using different language to talk about the same thing. And so I had a debate with Mel Slater at IEEE VR. I mean, he says that he's doing something completely different, but I just saw that he wasn't seeing everything about what was happening with presence. And again, he was only looking at the specific sensory motor contingencies that were unique to VR. But he did actually in 2022, he updated it with other people. He added the body ownership illusion and the co-presence illusion. So he has like the co-presence, which has a little bit more of the social dimensions, and then also the body ownership illusion. But again, he's still using this kind of illusionary framing. And this is something that David Chalmers criticized Slater in Reality Plus, because when you're in a virtual experience, sometimes it doesn't matter whether or not you are in a virtually mediated experience or not, as long as you have like an authentic experience of like feeling like you're talking to other person. It doesn't matter that they're not actually there. So a lot of the co-presence illusion is kind of cast onto whether you're actually there or not. But that kind of illusionary framing, I think, is limiting for presence. And that also, it creates a little bit of a blind spot of not looking at things like agency or emotions, because you can have emotions independent of whatever medium you're looking at. So part of my argument has been to look at things like active presence, mental, social presence, emotional presence, and embodied environmental presence. Okay, so I'm going to look into a little bit of the historical literature of experiential marketing that Chertoff was leaning upon, just to give you a broader context for prior work for other people who have been looking at this. So in 1999, there was this whole paper on experiential marketing, and they had these strategic experiential modules. And in that, they had act, think and relate, sense and feel. And then in 2009, in terms of measuring brand experiences, what is it? How is it measured? Does it affect loyalty? And they came up with behavioral, intellectual, affective, and sensory. And then Young, he actually was looking at the elements and being inspired by them. And he came up with these psychological types. And he was coming up with intuition, thinking, feeling, and sensing. And then you can think about like the mind, body, soul, and spirit, and whether or not you think the body is more primary, whether the spirit is more primary, like more the top down from the bottom up. You can basically come up with the body and the mind and the soul and the spirit. The soul being like more of the emotions and the feeling, the spirit, like your aspirations, your desires, and your body, obviously your sensory experience and your mind. And so there's kind of an intuitive way that we already are using some language to talk about these different elements. Then there's a whole predictive coding theory of neuroscience, which is that you have the mental models of reality and you're making predictions and your expectations, and you're actually having a direct sensory experience of that. And so there's a feedback loop there between your expectations, also your sensory experience. And so you have the mental models and then your sensory experience. Then there's the perception, decision, action loop, which I can break down into like perception and environment, the decision and action. Frank Svendeke and IEEE online, he gave a whole talk around the perceptual loops with virtual reality, how there's at each one of these different layers of the perception, cognition, and action, you can start to have interventions with the virtually mediated technologies. And so again, perception, environment, cognition, and action. There's also like active inference and the free energy principle, which is kind of like essentially kind of the same type of loop that is similar to these here. And there's also Boyd's OODA, that's the observation, orientation, decision, and action loop. And so this is a loop that I think is interesting, just because the orientation part, you can see here to the right, is basically like a synthesis of all these different things together. It's like you are taking all of your subject domain knowledge and you're basically kind of like fusing it all together. In Whiteheadian process philosophy, this would be what he calls concrescence or prehension, being able to kind of grasp at things and kind of synthesize together. So you're kind of like anticipating the future and integrating the past. And so for that, you have the observation, the orientation. So that water element is sort of that synthesis of everything coming together and you're orienting, but you're making a decision and you're acting. And for the OODA loop, you can see that it's actually a feedback loop between each of these different vectors. It's not like a clean cycle, but they're actually kind of like all feeding into each other. But I think the OODA loop is a pretty good way of kind of orienting to that. Then there's like Gartner's multiple intelligence. So we start to get into different things like the linguistic and mathematical, logical, and body kinesthetic, and different levels of intelligence. And then, you know, when we think about large language models, they're mostly the kind of the error element of just the language. But a lot of the thing that, you know, when I went to the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence, there's these other cognitive architectures and models where in order to actually have a more robust artificial intelligence, you need to be able to lean into having a world model, being able to predict and perception. And so there's this perception and world model, the planning configurator and the memory, the action. And then Jan LeCun says that emotions determine a sort of anticipation of outcomes. And when I went to the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence in 2018 and 2016, as I was developing this theory, I was actually seeing that there are a lot of parallels between, as you start to break down each guy, you can start to see that fire element being a lot of the multi-agents and multi-agent systems. And then obviously there's a lot of the error element of knowledge representation and reasoning, natural language processing, planning and scheduling, constraint satisfaction, optimization, multidisciplinary tools and applications, humans and AI, the more social dimensions, search and uncertainty, And then the water element being more storytelling aspects, AI ethics, trust and fairness, AI for good, and AI for arts. And then for the earth element, a lot of the machine learning is more the bottom up, using the neural network architectures to be able to give it a direct empirical experience. And from that, it has all the different weights. So a lot of the computer vision and machine learning that we've seen, but also robotics is sort of like an embodiment of AI in a way that actually has a physical body. So in 2025, we're starting to see a lot more of like this next phase of actual robots that are walking around. Okay, so if you want to boil it down, I think about behaviors and agency, thoughts and relations, feelings, and more the experiential aspects that are unfolding over time, and then sensations and immersion, and the fire, air, earth, and water. Okay, so that's a little bit more of the elemental approach of looking at presence, and I want to talk a bit about the philosophical roots of these elements because I feel like it helps me to find a grounding and these different patterns to be able to then extrapolate, because the elements go all the way back to Empedocles, but there isn't necessarily like a way to tie it together into today's cosmology. And so I think with process philosophy, there's actually a way to make a bridge to the elements into a modern day phenomenological framework that we can use to talk about our own experience. Okay, so just a brief kind of history of philosophy. For the last 2,000 years, there's been this dialectic between Plato, who is describing these Platonic realms of ideal forms, and then also like this physical reality. And so what's this relationship between the mind and body, essentially? This has been the kind of a vexing question for philosophy for like a couple of millennia now. And so you have this mind and matter. What's more primary? Is it mind or is it matter? So Plato, he had this kind of Platonic ideal that there is this Plato's cave where it's a little bit of like the Matrix was very much inspired by this idea that there's this kind of like true reality, but we're just like in this more mediated environment where we're just looking at these shadows on the cave, but like the real deep reality is way beyond here as we have to metaphorically break out of the Matrix or step out of the cave to see the actual reality. And so there's this breaking out of the firmament that is represented in this Flammarion perspective, but there's this idea that actually this kind of Platonic idea has really took hold within the context of mathematics, because mathematicians, they see that math objects are more discovered than invented. And so there's this idea that these Platonic realm of ideal forms exist outside of space-time, this non-spatial temporal realm, and that there are these non-Boolean deeper truths that we can have axioms that are getting some access to those truths that are having some relationship to reality. So this whole relationship between what's in relationship between math and reality is a big open question still. But for Plato, he was thinking about this idea of idealism, and he's basically saying that all is mind, that mind is the most primary thing and that matter is manifesting out of that. Well, the opposite was kind of like the existing metaphysics that we have right now is that matter is the basis of all reality and that it's all made out of stuff. And then you have substance, physics, chemistry, biology, psychology. And then at the top, consciousness is sort of like emergent out of all this physical matter. And there's also this idea of dualism, which maybe there's some sort of both, like you can have this kind of matter, but there's this interface between the mind. We don't know what this bridge is, but maybe both are happening when you have this kind of default to dualism. And so, yeah, you kind of have this mind-body split from Descartes. So Richard Tarnas in The Passion of the Western Mind basically recounts all the history of philosophy for the last 2,000 years as this kind of dialectic between the Platonic realm and the physical realm. And there's also this deeper question as to where is consciousness? Is it emergent out of our physicality, or is it actually more fundamental? Does it go beyond space and time? Or is it universal, this idea of either panpsychism or panexperientialism? So panpsychism is that there will be like little bits of mind and every little bit of matter. And panexperientialism is what Whitehead is around. And he's much more thinking about, rather than space and matter being the ultimate nature of reality, he's saying that time is the ultimate nature of reality. And so with that, he's saying it's actually experience all the way down. The ultimate nature of reality is experience. So I'm a Whiteheadian pan-experientialist, so I see that it's experience all the way down. Because I think it kind of fits with what we're doing here with XR in a way that we're kind of needing a new philosophical paradigm. So Abernorth Whitehead's process philosophy. Whitehead was a mathematician. He wrote the Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell. He was trying to prove that all of mathematics could be based upon logic. That failed with Gödel and completeness because you could either be consistent or complete, but not both. But for Whitehead, that kind of liberated him, according to what Matt Siegel has told me, and that he kind of went off and said, well, if logic isn't the basis of all reality, maybe there's deeper things of like feeling, emotion, and intuition that we need to start to really start to prioritize. And then Bertrand Russell went off and basically started the analytic philosophy branch that tried to base all philosophy onto logic, which was already failed within Gödel, but he kind of was relentless of pushing that forward. And that's kind of the dominant branch of philosophy that we've had for the past like 100 years or so. So there's this paradigm shift from materialism to a process relational philosophy. So we're moving from a substance ontology. And so for Whitehead, it's an event ontology. So in order to have an event ontology, he has to create all this language. And so it's like this nested set of processes and what he calls actual occasions. And actual occasions are these moments. They're drops of experience where contrast is secured by pulses of emotion. And so experience all the way down for Whitehead. And so you can think about, like, we live in the context of the Big Bang, and that's an unfolding process at a cosmic scale, but we're on Earth, and that's also unfolding on a geologic scale. We're also human beings that are also unfolding in our lives. And so it's processes within processes within processes. And so we're moving from substance to process. And Andrew Davis has this amazing book that's going to be coming out later this year called Whitehead's Universe, A Prismatic Introduction to Whitehead. And we're moving from, and I love this because he could be writing this about XR, but this is basically like the process philosophical foundations. We're moving from nouns to verbs, things to happenings, discrete individuality to active relations, separateness and independence to relationality and interdependence, fixity and stability to innovation and novelty, surface level change to fundamental change, eternity to temporality, passivity and indifference to activity and participation, and then being to becoming. So we're moving from like these static concrete objects into a dynamic flux. It's like this Heraclitus idea that you can't step in the same river twice. That if all the nature of reality is time, then it's these unfolding processes and relationships are the fundamental building blocks of the nature of reality rather than these Lego building blocks of stuff, materiality. Okay, so I've done like 5 different episodes on process philosophy that you can go look and listen a lot more to these scholars. And I've done a lot of time just kind of speaking with them, trying to get a sense of Whitehead's ideas. And what's great is that a lot of what I'm doing with the elements and the experiential design framework, because Whitehead saw experience as so primary, there's a lot of ways that experiential design in this framework gives like embodied spatial metaphors to understand process philosophy. So the more that I study Whitehead, the more I understand XR. The more I study XR, the more I can understand this giving embodied spatial metaphors for process philosophy. Okay, so here's a way of looking at the elements in this kind of Venn diagram where you start to have these intersections. And this is what I'll be covering in the last section here. But before I get to that, I want to give a little bit more of this philosophical foundations for other ways that we can start to think about these elements. So there's a book called The Geometry of Meaning by Arthur M. Young. And he was a really interesting guy. He was basically the inventor of the Bell helicopter. And he started looking into more of these esoteric ideas and using his math brain. And he was assigning different elemental balances to different philosophical traditions. So you can see the air element as like rationalism and idealism, the earth element as like empiricism. And pragmatism is actually kind of like this blending of earth and water. And then you have like mysticism as more water element. Existentialism is more the fire. It's all about freedom. So you can start to see at these different intersections, these existing philosophical traditions and branches. And at the center, I am making the claim that process philosophy is kind of like the fusion of all these different elements. There's a way in which that a process philosophical approach is kind of like taking the best of all these different traditions and fusing them together. This is another way from like 1666, kind of like these more hermetic ways of looking at earth, air, fire, and water in different ways that they're being combined. And I'll be digging into the metaphysics of the hot, cold, wet, and dry in a bit. But I want to first frame this in a process philosophical unfolding process where the earth element is the past, the air element is the future. So we're kind of inheriting the past, we're anticipating the future, the possibilities of what might happen. So there's a possibility space and an actual space. And then the present moment, there's this fusion of our emotions that are synthesizing the possibilities of the future, but also inheriting the past. And there's also our agency and our free will, our desire, our intentions that are also there. The livelessness of live, what happens from moment to moment. So in this process philosophical approach, the future is indeterminate and it's actually unfolding from moment to moment. And so there's a really great book called Untying the Gordian Knot by Timothy Eastman. And so he's basically taking process and reality. And he was a plasma physicist, and now he's a process philosopher in his retirement. And so he did an incredible job of taking all of this stuff from process philosophy and bringing up to modern cosmological perspective. So as a plasma physicist, he's like tying in all these things from like Peircean semiotics. He's basically applying Whitehead's ideas to the frontiers of quantum ontology. So there's this idea that there's a Boolean and non-Boolean space. So there's a way in which that Whitehead, he's resolving this mind-body split by turning it into a process. So he's saying that you're moving from the mental pole to the physical pole, and that's actually an unfolding process from this logic of potentialities into this logic of actualities. And the logic of potentialities is non-Boolean. It's a fuzzy logic. And we can sort of see this is happening with AI. It's using sort of Bayesian inference and these fuzzy logic and ways that we're moving beyond binary logic into these more non-Boolean logics to be able to more accurately describe the nature of reality. So there's this split between the non-Boolean many-valued spectrum of the possible space and then the logic of actualization. You start to have the law of excluded middle and the true-false binary, where there's a definite true-false answer once it gets grounded into actuality. But when it's in the archetypal realm, there's kind of like this non-Boolean possible space that can be paraconsistent in a way that there's things that don't mesh with each other. It's like the wave function in quantum ontology. Once it collapses, then you actually have an ability to say, okay, this is true, false. So there's this whole paper by Kastner, Kaufman, and Epperson, where they're basically arguing that we should look back to Heisenberg because he was taking potentia seriously. So basically, there's this idea of res extensia, res potentia. Res extensia is the extended reality. That's the matter. Res potentia is the possible space. And so they're saying that there's not a dualism of mutually exclusive substances in the classical Cartesian sense, and therefore does not inherit the infamous mind-body problem. Rather, res potentia and res extensia are understood as mutually implicative ontological extants. So basically, they're saying that both the archetypal potentials and the actuals are both real. And in fact, you can't have one without the other. They mutually imply each other. So they're mutually implicative. So this is basically saying this potential space is just as real as the actual. So we think about like speculative future, science fiction, that creates a imagination of what's possible, and that gets ingressed into reality as an actuality. So these actualities and possibilities are both real from process philosophy perspective. And so that's why when we look at this kind of illusionary framing from Mel Slater, no. It's like all this stuff is just as real. Well, I'm having a direct embodied experience. It may be mediated through this digital, but I'm having real authentic human experiences, emotions, intentions, social dynamics. My body is having real sensations. I don't have to say that it's fake and not real because I'm not grounded in substance. So this is a way to kind of push back against that illusionary framing to say that actualities and possibilities are both real and they actually are mutually implicative of each other. The res extensia and res potentia of what's actual and what's possible are actually both real. So you have this mental pole of the Platonic realm. And then for Whitehead, it's kind of ingressing into reality. And actually the Platonic realm doesn't really exist absent from the ingression into an actual occasion, so in the physical reality. And once it becomes in the physical reality, then it becomes more of a habit of a process that's unfolding. But for Epperson as a theorist, they're saying that every single bit of matter can have a trace back, so you can basically trace it back to a contextual relationship, back to the quantum event that's happening. And so for them, they're seeing that there is this kind of deep relationality in context. And so you can never have an objectified number independent of context. So for Eastman, he's saying it's input, output, context. It's a triadic system. So you can never have anything that's independent from that context. And you can see that from every single physical thing being a relational dynamic back into this potential is emphasizing that. Okay, so you have the mental pole of what's possible and then what's actual. And you're anticipating the future. So we can think about each moment we're thinking about what might happen. Experientially, we can think about the possible space for what may happen in the future. And then you're inheriting all the past of what has come before. So it's like the fates of reality, where that's something that is before your time and you have no agency over. And then you have the creative lure and subjective aim. So it's your intention. And so for Whitehead, creativity is kind of like the base nature of reality. And for Whitehead, he has it kind of as a dipolar, like creativity and God for him are basically at the same level. He's this idea that the creative lure of our intentions or creativity is the ultimate nature of reality. And that why is there novelty when we see evolution is because we all have this desire to have something that's interesting and novel. We can look at the predictive coding theory of neuroscience, and whenever there's things that are novel, it gives us dopamine hits because it's trying to update our idea of what the nature of these models are. And so there's a way in which that the predictive theory of neuroscience is kind of emphasizing novelty as a key part of the nature of reality. So we're acting on decisions that limit the possibilities. So you have a possibility space and making a decision, you're actually cutting off those possibilities. And so you're making a choice and taking action on that. And then the water element is kind of feeling in the present. For Whitehead, he's called it prehension. And prehension is kind of a grasping. And so you can think about grasping at the possible space and then what's coming in. And then also your intuition about what actions you want to take and trying to trace all the causal loops there. So there's contrasting cycles and pulses of emotion, synthesizing possibilities and integrating the past. So for Whitehead, emotions end up being a really crucial thing where everything is kind of centered in emotion. So much of reductive materialism is trying to deny our experience as even a thing. And then there's a lot that Whitehead was looking to these romantic poets that were trying to see the writing on the wall if we go down this kind of reductive materialism where we say that our own direct experience doesn't exist and it's just an illusion. He's pushing back against that and he's trying to create a framework that centers our human experience as the most important thing. And with that, the emotions often get ignored from many different models, but they're so key for Whitehead. So this is like his theory of concrescence, and this is like way too much for you to like digest, but Whitehead is basically coming up with 8 categories of existence and 27 categories of explanation. I'm highlighting the different categories of existence. For Whitehead, he's saying the mind, thinking, number, air element are these eternal objects. So rather than Jungian archetypes, he's looking at these pure potentialities, these eternal objects for a specific determination, facts or forms. And those are ingressing into reality as these actual occasions, eventually these actual entities, which is kind of at the very center. Everything is getting to these actual occasions, these moments. So they're drops of experience or pulses of emotion. That's kind of fusing together all those other elements as well. And then he's looking at the kind of earth element as nexus and public matters of fact, propositions. Creativity is not a category of existence, although it could be. You can see that he's combining that as novelty as each of these. And then the air and water is sort of the contrasts or the modes of synthesis between those. And then the water element being these pretensions or concrete facts. So essentially, there's a way to take Whitehead's theories of crescents and start to map it over here. And there's lots of neologisms, but once I have this, then it becomes a lot more accessible to be able to start to dig into what Whitehead's doing. But as a mathematician, he's basically defining here's the process. Here's the event ontology where you're able to kind of synthesize all the moments of the past. So as a spatial metaphor, this concrescence, you can think about there's sequential time, but there's also non-sequential time. So there's all these moments of the past that are kind of concrescing. So there's kind of like these moments that hit this zeitgeist of a moment. So you can think about it as these waves of things that are coming into the past, and that as an experiential designer, you are cultivating this, bringing all these things together to have an emotional experience for people, to give them satisfaction, to achieve your goals, achieve your ends. Okay, so then I'm going to dig into a little bit of historical philosophy, then we'll dig into the blending of the elements. So Empedocles, he had this cosmic cycle between love and strife and spheros. And so there's a quote that says, "The world's course is determined rather by an irregular alternation between a period of increasing love, which leads towards a total mixture of the four elements, and then a period of strife, which leads towards a total separation of the elements." So for Empedocles, he's seeing like this larger cycle, this process from love and strife, and that the elements are kind of like blending and coming in and out of together. And so the earth, air, fire, and water. So there's also this medical origins of hot, cold, wet, and dry, basic opposites that are looking at their roots that are first found in nature. There's the Hippocratic nature of man. The four opposites were brought into line with humors. So basically the choleric, sanguine, phlegmatic, and melancholic. And there's a lot of ways that the Renaissance and ancient medical theories were kind of based upon these elements and trying to apply them to our direct human experience. There's a lot of ways in which that acupuncture has preserved a sort of experiential dimension. They actually use 5 elements instead of 4. Ayurveda also uses the elements. So there's existing lineages that are continuing to use this kind of elemental approach in the context of medicine, where we don't see that as much here in the Western scientific paradigm. So there's this hot, cold, wet, and dry. So you can think about the hot as the active and expanding, moving upwards. And so there's more of the yang energy moving upwards. And then the cold is more of the earth and the water. It's more passive and constricting. And then on the left side, you have dry, which is separative and resisting. And on the right, you have wet, which is connective and flowing. You think about the wet and dry in terms of if you're dehydrated, that it's not going to be good for your body. You need to have enough liquids, but also if you have inflammation, that's not great as well. So you have different ways that you can think about these spatial metaphors as how they are operating in our body. But basically, you can think about your energy going outward with the actor presence and mental social presence, but you're also kind of receiving your sensory experience and your emotions. You also don't have agency over what you're feeling. And so there's ways that it's kind of like fated of some sorts, was what Spinoza was thinking about, that kind of fatedness of feeling. But we can look at the yang and the yin, which is like moving upwards, going outwards, and the fire and air more the yang, and the earth is the yin, more receptive. And so you have outward giving and taking, and then more inward receiving and listening. So the yang and yin is basically the day and the night. And so you can look at the flow between the day and night and to see how there's the kind of the sun and the moon and different metaphors of giving, receiving, reflecting that are also kind of embedded into more Chinese philosophy. But again, this kind of hot and cold, wet and dry, there's also a ordering that Aristotle had, which is that he said that fire in whatever quantity, so long as there's no external obstacle, moves upward and the earth downward. And so he's coming up with the natural places. And so the earth is at the bottom, then it's water, then air, then fire. And, you know, so he's saying that since air and inequality rises to the surface of water, while water and inequality sinks to the bottom of the air. So basically, this is the passage where Aristotle is defining the, quote, natural places of the four elements. And we can start to compare that to solid, liquid, gas, and plasma, where there's increasing energy each of these, but you can also think about it in terms of degrees of freedom, where when you have like the materiality of the earth element, you have less degrees of freedom than your desire, your will, your aspirations. Like you're unconstrained as to what you might want. And then your ideas are also very free, your imagination. And then your emotions, again, you don't have like direct control over that. But you can see that these metaphors from solid, liquid, gas, plasma has this kind of like energy that is moving upwards. And then we have the quadrivium, which is being able to look at astronomy, geometry, music, and math. And so math is numbers abstractly. The abstractions of math is number. And then numbers in space is geometry. Numbers and time is music. And then numbers and space and time is astronomy. So this is a way that I'm applying what I see with the quadrivium and starting to say, okay, well, actually the water element is numbers and time, earth as numbers and space, the abstractions of the mind is number abstractly, and then numbers and space and time is your dynamics. So you could look at it as objects moving through space, physics and dynamics, the abstract patterns and forms of the rules and mechanics, the unfolding processes of the constants and distance and time, and then the world and body and architecture and embodiment in space. So then we can start to look at Aristotle's four causes. Again, the sort of the highest level of most energy is what is the purpose, the teleological impulse. And for Whitehead, that's novelty and creativity. For Whitehead, he's saying that's the ultimate nature of reality is this creativity. So that's at the base. And then you have, what is it? It's the blueprint, the mass structure, the design, shape, the archetype. So for Whitehead, that's the eternal objects. These are the archetypes. And so there's a way in which the blueprint of the plan that you have is somehow influencing reality, but also there may be an ingression of these eternal objects into physical reality. And then you have the efficient causes, which is basically looking at two things like smashing into each other, and you see a direct causal effect. So where does change come from? So these are the direct observable cause and effect. And for material cause from a substance metaphysics, you would say, well, what's it made of? It's made out of wood. But for Whitehead, because it's an event ontology, it's time. So it's made out of time. So it's events, time, pulses of emotion, actual occasions, drops of experience, and value. So material cause is probably not the best term because we're in an event ontology, not a substance metaphysics, but you get a sense of how each of these are tied to these different causal aspects. And the final cause and formal cause are not really considered very much within Western science. I think it's making a comeback with folks like Michael Levin and others that are trying to go beyond reductive materialism into these new paradigms. And I think that final cause and formal cause are one of those. So there's a whole bunch of other esoteric archetypal attributes of the four elements. And these are kind of more axiomatic from these specific esoteric traditions. These are hard to find in any sort of philosophical book. It's coming from this very specific tradition. But I think there's existing traditions from Ayurveda to Hermeticism to astrology to magic. You just like Google for archetypal representations of the elements, you'll come up with some of these. But this is specifically from a book called Astrology for Yourself, a Workbook for Personal Transformation by Dimitri George and Douglas Block. And so when I was looking at developing my elemental theory, I was looking to see what are the associations. And this is how I originally derived what eventually Chertoff came up independently. So for fire element, it's warm, energetic, creative, passionate, courageous, free, active, and spirited. And again, there's lots of other archetypal potentialities for what that could mean that you can take a look at here. And then on the left is basically a skillful application. The right is more unskillful. So for air, it's mental, intellectual, abstract, communicative, social, curious, objective, and clever. For water element, it's nurturing, feeling, emotional, empathetic, compassionate, bonding, absorptive, and flowing. And then for earth, it's practical, pragmatic, grounded, physical, tangible, and sensuous. The great thing about the elements is that we all have our own embodied metaphors for what our experience with earth, air, water, and fire might be. And so it's literally endless with the different types of significations that you can start to come up with. But I feel like it's a really good grounding in terms of like coming up with a framework for phenomenology and talking about the human experience. And it's very robust as well. So again, the hot, cold, wet, and dry is kind of the ordering principle of all these elements. But ultimately, you can think about it as behaviors and agency, thoughts and relations, feelings and experiential, and sensations and immersion. Okay, the final section here, I'm going to be talking about examples of going on the immersive film festival circuit and seeing how I'm seeing at these intersections, how there's a blending of these elements and kind of an unpacking of some of these different experiences. So again, these are the elements, and I'm sort of deciding on the terms of interactivity and dynamics for fire, language and social for air, feelings and time for water, and then sensations and space for earth. But there's lots of different other significations that are archetypal that I can't necessarily list, but I'll be explicating it as I go through. So let's first look at interactivity and dynamics, the fire element. We have something like Job Simulator, which I think is kind of like a paradigmatic example of you going into an experience and making sure that every single object that are going to be interacted with, you can interact with it. So it's basically, I think, setting the stage for the extent to which what people are expecting when it comes to being able to engage with the affordances of all these objects and also combine them in all sorts of interesting ways. So this is kind of like a paradigmatic example of the fire element of this kind of game-like agency and interactions. So that's the interactivity and dynamics. And so I'm going to be sort of going around each of these. And so let's move to the language and social, the air element. So we have Horizon. This is an immersive theater piece that I saw at IFA Doc Lab in 2022. And so I was talking to a 15-year-old and I had to engage in a conversation where I had to tell them what their future was going to look like in 30 years. I was 45 years old at the time and they were 15. And so I was the age that they were going to be. And then they were asking me questions like, am I going to be able to live in Amsterdam? Is it going to be flooded with global warming? And I had to basically tell them a story that was like, well, I don't know, but it'll all work out for you. But I was confronted with this experience of having to have this amount of speculative imagination of these social dynamics and be able to have a conversation with them. That's all it was a conversation. There's no technology. So this is kind of like the extent of the speculative imagination and social dynamics, the types of things that you're starting to see with kind of a pure air element expression. So that was the language and social for the air element. And then we're going to move into the feelings and time of the water element. So you think about 360 video and Traveling While Black, where I was able to be transported into a series of different conversations and moments that had I been there in a space with all people of color, the conversation might have changed. I felt like I was able to sort of become a ghost and bear witness to a story. But this kind of cinematic VR, I don't have any agency. I'm a ghost, essentially, but I'm watching all the different ideas from film, the film tradition, being able to cut up and be able to tell stories in a very specific way. So that's the feelings and time for the water element. Now we look at the sensations and space for the earth element. So I think of Meow Wolf as like a paradigmatic example of this, where this is an immersive art installation that is really the extent of world building and immersive art, where you're being transported into another world. And it's a lot of a spatial experience where you're walking around from context to context, and it's basically redesigning a bowling alley to make you feel like you're being transported into another realm. It's really quite incredible if you haven't seen it, but it really gets to the sense of like this deep sensory immersion of being immersed within a context, a spatial context. So that's the sensations in space. Now let's start to look at the combination between the fire and air. That's the interactivity and dynamics with the language and social. So Dungeons and Dragons is a great example of this, where you're basically using your imagination. And again, if you see the circle, you can see a center of gravity of the air element of your imagination is centered. It's centered of being able to express your depths of your imagination. There's also social dynamics that are happening, but it's basically a lot of agency and improv and these kind of rules that are also happening that are creating some boundedness. But it's like the extent of no friction. Like there's nothing stopping you from doing anything you want because it's just your imagination. And the only thing that's stopping you is the rules. But then you have the dungeon master who's basically have the ability to use discretion as to whether or not you can break the rules or not. But it's all around like the ability to kind of like have a good story. So that's the interactivity and dynamics of the fire and the air. Now we have the air with water, the language and social with feelings and time. So this is a piece called Borderline Visible. The center of gravity is it's a collective reading experience, but it's a time-based experience of the book. He created an hour-long reading of the book where you have the book and he's telling you to turn to different pages. And so as a group, you're collectively reading it together. So you're using your mind to read the language, but it has the time dimension because it creates a experiential part where you're all doing it together in a social dynamic. So it's like a group collective reading experience that was at IFA Doc Lab. So the combination of the air and the water. So Another is COSM. So this is like coming from the cinematic tradition of being in a big, huge dome, but they call it shared reality, which is basically a shared experience. The way that they've architected the seats is in a U shape. So it's all around you connecting to other people and having a shared social experience, whether you're watching a film, The Matrix, or whether you're watching a live sporting event. But it's the deepest context is like the cinematic tradition, the time element of the water, but you're having this kind of shared social reality. Okay, so that's the air and water of the language and social with the feelings and time. Now let's move to the fire and water, which is interactivity and dynamics and feelings and time. This is basically the ludonarrative conflict between whether or not you're playing or you're having the story. This is a piece called Lesbian Simulator, where it was a documentary story of a lesbian who created this experience, wanting to give you an experience of what it's like to be a lesbian. And so you're doing lots of different actions throughout the course of this piece. You have to say, I am gay, as a part of the coming out experience. And there's other people that are around within a public context. So there's a way that, you know, just even saying that within the context of you being in VR and you can't see anybody around creates this kind of recreation of that. But there's also these moments where you're holding the hand of your lesbian same-sex partner and you start to get grief from people in the restaurant that are with you. And you have to decide whether or not to face that grief or to make your girlfriend mad by not holding her hand. And so it creates this kind of actions where you have to actually take action. And after I did this experience walking around Amsterdam, I saw same-sex couples holding their hands. And it actually changed my perception of like, oh, wow, that's actually a radical act of rebellion that I didn't fully appreciate before I did that experience. And so there's ways in which that these experiences by having these recreations can allow us to really empathize with other people. And then there's the line that's won at Venice in 2019. It's a narrative story. And there's ways that the interactivity is just gating the story. And so you're just pushing something that basically like pushing a button to move forward. So there's ways that it's kind of recreating the actual mundane routines of the person. So there's a way that kind of fits, but sometimes interactivity can basically just be for activity that doesn't necessarily always serve the story. How can you make the interactions really serve the story? But I just wanted to sort of show this Leibowitz and Clug interactive storytelling spectrum, because there is this spectrum between authored narrative where we have no agency and to generative narrative where you have a lot of agency. So you have the three-act structure from Aristotle. Then you have the interactive traditional story where you have little choices that you're making that it's kind of flavoring experience. And then when you get the middle, you get these branching path stories that every choice you make takes you down a different narrative path. And so you have the opportunity to really finely tune the archetypal expression that someone wants. But it takes a lot of energy to do that. And people go through it. They don't always recognize that you have like, you know, 95% of the piece that they didn't even get a chance to experience. So these are a little bit more rare. But then you get into more open-ended stories where you start to have more spatial dimensions of you moving around and treating it more like a sandbox, where it's more about you expressing your agency than it is about receiving a story. Facade solved this by having a drama manager, by paying attention to all the choices you make, and then it delivers you the best story beat based upon whatever choices you made up to that point. So there's a way of preserving that narrative integrity. But once you get to the very end, it's much more of an open world, and it's harder to tell a compelling story once you're at that extent, because it's more about you expressing your agency in a possibility space than it is about you receiving a story. Okay, so that's the fire and the water, the interactivity and dynamics with feelings and time. We'll go to sensations and space, earth and water. So this is one that I see a lot of in terms of the XR community, where you're in a spatial context and you're having a story. So this is one of the winners from Venice Immersive 2025, where they have Gaussian splats that you're in a spatial context, but they have a story within that context. Then there's songs for a passerby, where you're actually like using recordings of your body and they're projecting you into the experience, but you're also walking around this big, vast space. And so there's a way that the embodiment and your spatial journey are all together, kind of wrapped up into this poetic dream logic. And then The Man Who Couldn't Leave was actually a cinematic VR piece, a 360 video that won at Venice in 2022. But they're using all sorts of like cinematic staging and spatial metaphors to be able to symbolically tell the story of this move towards authoritarianism in Taiwan. It's a really incredible 360 video. And then In 36,000 Ways was at IFA Doc Lab this year. And this is a piece that is talking about these pieces of shrapnel. There's 36,000 pieces of shrapnel for every missile that hits and it explodes out. So when you walk up into this installation, the lights go out and you put on headphones, you hear your heartbeat because there's a thermal camera that's recording your heartbeat, and you feel the haptic butt kicker underneath. So you're feeling your heartbeat as you listen to the story of how modern day warfare uses these pieces of shrapnel to basically ignore all human rights. But you have this deep sculptural staging and embodied haptics with this kind of time-based aspect of the story as it's unfolding, with the lighting as well. Okay, so that's the earth and water. Now we have the earth and air, so the sensations of space, language, and social. You have the collective body. So this is a piece where you're moving your body, but based upon how you move your body, they're giving you an archetypal representation of the elements. But you also see other people that are also dancing. So you have this shared experience of you expressing your identity through your movement. And it's this like collective experience with you doing this with other people. And then Chronicles of Milkman Zero is a really odd experience because it's a theatrical piece, but it's basically a text-based adventure of a person performing, playing a text-based adventure. So you're literally just reading what he's saying, but he's acting in a way of like a theatrical staging. So you can start to see this blending of like you reading with this kind of theatrical staging of how you're starting to blend these elements together of the air and earth. Okay, then the earth and fire. This is the interactivity, dynamics, and sensations in space. So yeah, this is a piece that actually won at South by Southwest called Body Proxy. And so it's using large language models with these glasses to be able to measure the archetypal representations. They're telling you to basically you're a proxy for AI because AI doesn't have an embodiment. So you, as a body proxy, you become the embodiment for the AI and you have these tasks, but you have to do things like fold a paper airplane. So you do that, and it's using large language models to be able to use an archetypal fuzzy logic detection of these actions that you're doing, but then it's measuring that and creating a whole game out of that. So it's kind of this computer vision of your body with this kind of creative embodied of actions. That was a kind of a sneak peek of where things are going here in the future. And also, whose body is being revealed? Do you have an embodiment? Do you not have a body in? Are you the character? Or are you watching somebody else's character? So this whole thing of like, are you a ghost? Do you have impact on the story? Is a lot of this question of your body. Does your body as a character have agency over the story? So do you have a character presence, and to what degree of impact do you have on that story? Okay, so that's the earth and fire. Now we're moving to the triplets, and we have just four more here and we're wrapping up here. So this is the earth, fire, and air. We have Handle with Care, which was, this is a box in a theatrical staging. And there's a note that says, this performance starts when everybody has had time to read this and one of you opens the box. And in the box is a series of instructions. And so the audience becomes the performer of this that unfolds over time. So you have the emergent social dynamics that are happening that are dictated by little bits of pieces of paper with instructions. And then people have to have, in the context of a theater, the audience then becomes those actors. Voice in My Head was a piece at IFADOC Lab, which is, you see a lot of people who are using ChatGPT as therapists. This is basically 2023, the first look at what happens if you start to give an aspiration for what you want to change about yourself, and you wear these headphones that are listening to all your conversations as you're walking around, and it's slowly like giving you feedback as to how to live into your aspirations. And so basically it's this AI feedback in these conversations, and it's using your voice and cloning your voice and talking to yourself as a voice in your head as you're walking around and doing this kind of real-time psychodynamic analysis, which, you know, certainly has a lot of privacy implications, but this was a piece that was at IFADOC Lab 2023. And then this is a piece of just at South by Southwest, Fabula Rasa, Dead Man Talking. So you are in a VR experience and you have to try to convince this king that you shouldn't be killed. And so you have to connect to each of the different village people. And so you're doing a lot of improv and gameplay. So they have a cognitive architecture of like all these large language models of Claude and OpenAI talking to each other. And so you have a conversational interface where you're able to use kind of like a D&D speculative imagination, but it's constrained by the world. So because they have the world, then they're able to do even more things like have objects that you're able to interact with and change the character dynamics of the interactions that you have dynamically, because you have different ways that you're able to kind of have this world and this unity, but with the AI, but with your improv. And so at the core, it's your improv, but the conversational AI, but within the context of the world. Then I Expect You to Die is one of the, you know, classics of escape rooms, but it's embodied gameplay, escape room puzzles, and an immersive world. Okay, so that's the earth, fire, and air. Now moving into fire, air, and water. We have COSM, so live sports. So liveness of the live of live sports. You're seeing it in an immersive dome, and you have a collective experience that makes you feel like you're at one of these games. I went to the NBA Finals. I'm from Indiana, so I'm a Pacers fan. They didn't win last year, but I got the chance to see them play in the finals, and I got like courtside seats, and it felt like I was there in a way that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to afford actually being there. And plus, I was in LA during AWE rather than in Indianapolis. And then there's a piece called Drinking Brecht, which was a really interesting, like, automated way of a performative lecture that had film, that had the lecture, but you also had to follow instructions to do a biohacking experiment of putting a DNA sample and testing it. And at the end, it uses all this alcohol, so you end up drinking it as an alcoholic beverage at the end. And so it was an underground speakeasy of you learning about Brecht. And so it was a lecture, social dynamics, and the whole purpose was for you to start to talk to other people. So there was a film that was facilitating information, a biohacking experiment that you were doing, but also a lecture in social dynamics. Okay, so that's the fire, air, and water. Here we have Earth, fire, and water. We have D-Day, the camera soldier on the Apple Vision Pro, a really amazing immersive documentary that takes you on a spatial journey of D-Day. It's telling a story and has light interactions, but it goes way beyond a simple 360 video and actually putting your body into the experience. It's really powerful. And then Organism by Dr. Morrow and VRChat. It's a really epic world-building experience with lots of exploration, surreal dream logic, really amazing experience. So that's the Earth, fire, and water. And then two more, we have Earth, air, and water. This is Blur. So Blur is, it's a mixed reality experience where you're going into mixed reality theater. You're having a lot of expectations. They're kind of modulating the space in a way that goes beyond, it's like a magic show, but they're also kind of like putting you into this kind of like surreal dream logic. And they have live immersive theater actors that are there as well. Okay. And then the final one is all the elements coming together. You can start to think about things like Half-Life Alyx and like, why is Half-Life Alyx so good? Well, it's a game. It has world-building embodiment. It has a story. It has puzzles. It's basically a very full and rich experience. You can start to look at each of the different kind of levels and how there's different balances of like, they'll context switch between whether it's more about the interaction, more about gaming. And yeah, it's just a really amazing kind of overall experience of the center of gravity that is really one of the more balanced immersive experiences that are out there and kind of a renowned as the best VR game that's ever been created. There's also the Collider, which is you exploring the boundaries between power and control. And then you're asked to think of a memory of when you had power over someone or someone had power over you. And then you start to play out these embodied metaphors of puppeteering, controlling another person. And so you're kind of projecting your memories onto this experience, having these interactions with social dynamics, with these embodied metaphors that are all playing out at the same time. And finally, Beat Saber. We all know and love this game. It has this deep kind of visceral music and this sense of time. You have an embodied experience and you have this mental predictions of like the puzzle of how to move your body to basically solve the spatial puzzle that's happening. And so again, one of the most popular successful games, when you start to look at elemental balance, it ends up being really quite balanced. So that's a kind of an overview of all the different elements and blending of the elements of like a framework to start to see how you can start to have this interdisciplinary fusion between all these different disciplines. And so, yeah, I talked about my design framework from experiential design, elements of theory presence, some philosophical roots for the elements, and then the blending of elements. And yeah, if you want a copy, send an email to me at kent@kentbuy.com. I'll send you the slides if you want to take a look, and I'll probably be posting this on my podcast as well. So awesome. So thank you. Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals, and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening. Thank you.